Nehemiah chapter 4 is where we're at. And Nehemiah is taken on the assignment of rebuilding the city walls because he's concerned. He's concerned about God's reputation, in a sense. He's concerned about the safety of God's people, and he's concerned about the reputation God will have if God's not protecting his people in some fashion. If God has brought his people back to a land and they falter, that they are destroyed immediately, what kind of God is taking care of them? So Nehemiah wants to come and rebuild these walls, takes on that assignment. It's very interesting because how many years has it been since the people returned to Jerusalem from exile? When that first group came with the Zerubbabel, it's been almost 80 years. 80 years without any form of protection. Now you would say, well, God was their protection, and that's true. But Nehemiah now wants to go back and rebuild those walls. He's taking on this massive construction project. But in Nehemiah chapter 4, 5, and 6, he undergoes a series of potential distractions. Things that try to prevent him from finishing the construction of that wall. And it's from this text that I want to kind of draw some distractions that our own families face, and then also to kind of make some application about how we can derail the distractions, how we can neutralize the distractions. But let's notice, in Nehemiah chapter 4, the very first thing you're going to encounter is a distraction of ridicule. It's Sanballat, this and his group of individuals who are opposing the construction of the city walls, that they start ridiculing them for their progress. So particularly in verse 2, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves, referring to the wall? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? And then Tobiah the Ammonite adds to it, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break it down. In other words, they're making fun of these guys for trying to take on this task. It seems to them too ridiculous, too big, and so they're ridiculing them. And ridicule is to me a modern distraction for the home because of our society. Our society is developing an intense ridicule of Christianity these days, and it's not necessarily affecting you and I. The effect is going to be on the next generation. Because our society is redefining love. Love, according to our society standards, is now tolerance. They equate to one another. And you aren't loving unless you're tolerating everybody else. And so that means there's in our society, that there's no ridicule for opposing same-sex marriage. There's ridicule for possessing a narrow view of marriage and divorce. There's ridicule for condemning abortion. There's ridicule for advocating that there is such a thing as absolute truth. And there is ridicule for not taking a position that all views are acceptable. For us, the more mature will say, those ridicules fall easily. But you take a kid who's in middle school right now, and their buddy at school comes out as gay later on. It's going to be a lot more difficult for them in our current society to stand with the Bible on the subject of homosexuality. You've probably started to experience that in your churches where the younger generation is starting to define love the same way our society is. And they're starting to accept things that you and I never had a problem defining as sin. And our society is desensitizing our kids, particularly when it comes to sexual relationships. And it's not helped that our schools are promoting safe sex rather than abstinence. And our kids are being desensitized to recreational drug abuse. If you pay attention to any show on television that's popular with younger audiences, smoking marijuana is of no consequence. It's just like having a drink of alcohol. Or even when it comes to submission to authority. Our society is teaching kids that they can be their own source of authority. They don't have to listen to someone who's a police officer. They don't have to listen to someone who's a parent. They don't have to listen to an eldership. And so our society is undermining the fabric of our young people by desensitizing them to those things. And that ridicule is going to hinder their development spiritually. So that's why it's important in the home, that the home becomes the place where nonconformity is taught. Home comes to place where Romans chapter 12 is taught and enforced. Because because our children need to see their parents and their grandparents demonstrating that you don't have to be like the world. Our children need to see our parents and our grandparents showing them that you don't have to buy into the world's standards. Too often we're depending on the youth ministers to teach that, or the guys in the pulpit, or the Sunday schools. Or if you have a Christian school like Mobile Christian, we assume you'll be taken care of there. Or when they go to Bible camp. Or maybe one day down the road they'll go to a Christian university and they'll learn it there. But it's got to start in the home. Because the home is where they're at majority of the time. If you're relying on a minister to accomplish it, you're relying on maybe 3, 4, 5 hours a week of interaction with somebody who's going to teach them about nonconformity. But if you provide it in the home, that's daily. And whose responsibility was it in Scripture to provide the spiritual education? It was the home. Ridicule is one thing that I think is a distraction for our families today, but I also think success is one. If you look at Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 6, I want you to see this verse. It's very simple. Nehemiah says, "We built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." Now, I know the text doesn't really say anything. It's what is not in that verse that's important. They didn't have a celebration because they got the wall to half its height. They didn't throw a big party. They didn't have a big memorial happen. They didn't do anything commemorating this as a milestone. That's important because we're really good at celebrating even the smallest victories. Think years ago when you were dating and you and your significant other had to celebrate every month that you were together. And you had to get her a rose or something and honor every month that you were together up until at least that first year. Or think about when you had your first child. And every month you had to take a picture of them because they were 1 month old, they were 2 months old. And you counted your child's age in months up until they were about three. And anybody that didn't have children, you would tell them how old, "Oh, my child's 26 months. And they're trying to calculate because they don't get it, you know. We celebrate the smallest milestones. We are a society that would probably throw a party because we got the wall up to half its height. We would celebrate that. But they didn't. Why? Because if they stopped the work, what would happen? Now, I want you to consider this. Success is another one of those potential distractions when it becomes one of our obsessions. For some, the success of their career becomes the obsession. For others, the success of their children and extracurricular activities becomes the obsession. And still for others, the success of whatever they are a fan of becomes the obsession. So it may be that some are so obsessed with their work life that they forget to prioritize their family. It may be that some are so obsessed with their kids being successful, whether it be in some sort of sport, some sort of entertainment arena, some sort of performance, some sort of educational acumen, whatever it is, they become so engaged with their children being successful that they forget about the spiritual education, or they diminish the importance of the spiritual education in their family. Or it may be that you're just so engrossed with your college football team and their success that it diminishes the importance of spiritual education in your home. You see, success can become one of those distractions quite easily. And another word for obsession is passion. Passion is defined as an extravagant fondness or enthusiasm or desire for something. When you're passionate about something, you possess intimate knowledge of it. You can't stop talking about it. You invest your resources in it. You make sacrifices on its behalf. And in the Bible, it's made very clear that the only thing to which we are to be passionate about, that we are to possess intimate knowledge of, that we are to speak continuously about, that we are to invest our resources in, that we are to make sacrifices for, is God. The Bible doesn't use the word passion in that context. Passion in the Bible always has to do with some sort of sexual context. But the word it uses is zeal, being zealous. And listen to some of these passages. God made in Numbers chapter 25, God made a covenant with Phinehas regarding the priesthood because Phinehas was zealous for his God. After the showdown at Mount Carmel, 1 Kings chapter 19, Elijah retreated to a cave in fear for his life because Scripture says he had been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts. In Psalm chapter 69 and Psalm chapter 119, David referred to zeal for God as something that consumed him. And then Proverbs chapter 23, verse 17. One proverb there says, do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. In other words, when we let our success, whether it be individually or within our children or in our passion for some other team, when we let that consume us, when we let that be what we're most passionate about, then we're detracting from God. And we're detracting from the emphasis that should be placed on Him. That becomes a distraction in our family. Because whenever you are more passionate about your career than your spiritual life, when you're more passionate about your children's activities than your spiritual life, whenever you're more passionate about your football team than your spiritual life, then guess what? That's called idolatry. And consider what Luke chapter 9, verse 23, what Jesus said there. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Where in that statement of Jesus is there room for my success? Do all to the glory of God, we're told. Our primary focus is to be agents of glorifying God rather than ourselves. And when our success starts to trump God's, or our interest in success of our children or our football team or whatever hobby you have, then you're leading your family away from God. What are your kids learning when your career is more important than going to church? What are your kids learning when being at the football game is more important than being at church? What are your kids learning when traveling with the baseball team is more important than being at church? And that brings me to the third thing that I want to point out here. Nehemiah chapter 4, look at verse 7 and 8. Not only is success an issue or a potential distraction, but so is conflict. Because here in verses 7 and 8, Sanballat and Tobiah, they're threatening to make war against Jerusalem. They're threatening to come in and attack. And guess what? It's a successful distraction. The battle never takes place, but what does end up happening is that they stop construction on the walls for a period of time. Why did Sanballat and Tobiah care? Why did these guys want to intervene at Jerusalem? Well, it comes down to this. Sanballat ruled Samaria, the territory just north of Jerusalem. Tobiah was the Ammonite. He ruled in the territory that was just east of Jerusalem, across the Jordan River. Geshem the Arab, he ruled Arabia, the territory that lay south of Jerusalem. In other words, these three guys ruled the territories that surrounded Judea, that surrounded Jerusalem. If Jerusalem rose from the ashes, then it would be a potential challenger to their kingdoms. And they cared a lot about their kingdoms. What kingdoms do you have? You see, we can also be guilty of being distracted by conflicting interests. And that happens when we decide that our hobbies and our interests are more important than God's kingdoms. When our kingdoms surpass His. It might be my kingdom of hunting, or my kingdom of fishing, or my kingdom of beach going, or my kingdom of sports, or my kingdom of rest, or my kingdom of watching the news, or my kingdom of social media. Preachers, how many times have you stood in the pulpit and watched people on Facebook in the pews because their kingdom of conversing on social media was more important than worshiping God that day? Have you ever just wanted to post something on Facebook to see how many likes you get while you're preaching? Like post it at the start of your sermon and see how many likes you get? Or tweet something and see how many responses come back? We all have kingdoms. And the problem is they become a distraction when they usurp the kingdom. What did Jesus say in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33? What was most important? Seek first the kingdom of God. And His righteousness. The problem is, we get distracted by other kingdoms. And all of us need to realize that the distractions of other kingdoms will in all likelihood be repeated by our children. Where did Isaac learn to lie about his relationship with his wife? Dear old dad. Where did Jacob learn to play favorites with his wives and his children? From his parents? Where did Jacob's sons learn to deceive their father as they did with the supposed death of Joseph? Well, they learned deception from dad. You see, the spiritual decisions we make today have a great chance of being emulated by our children tomorrow. And so if my kingdoms start to trump my participation in the kingdom of God, or if my kingdoms trump my relationship with God, what do you think my kids are going to learn? God's kingdom really isn't that important. For me, those are three potential distractions that rise up today. They're not the only distractions that are dealt with here. There's also the distraction of discouragement in verse 10 in chapter 5. There's distractions of selfishness, of comfort. In chapter 6, you have the distraction of slander, of fear, of compromise. Nehemiah dealt with a lot of distractions, but what we need to really finish up on in our last few minutes here is how did Nehemiah neutralize distraction? Look at verse 9 of chapter 4. Nehemiah's strategy was this. He says that they prayed to God and set a guard as a protection against their enemies day and night. Real quick, three things that I pick up on here. When it comes to neutralizing distractions, the first step is an intimate and consistent communication with God. Nehemiah is a great example of someone who prays consistently. In chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, he's praying. In chapter 5, verse 19, he's praying. In chapter 6, verse 9 and verse 14, he's praying. And prayer aids in neutralizing distractions because of what James chapter 4 says. James chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. What I notice in those instructions is a collaboration. It seems that James is saying that as you submit to God, you will simultaneously draw near to him, and by necessity of drawing closer to God, you will resist the devil, and as a result of your resistance, the devil will flee from you. It seems pretty logical that it all kind of flows together. So if you want a strategy for neutralizing distractions, start by that. Start by drawing closer to God, because as you draw closer to God, it's going to affect your home. The other thing that Nehemiah does is he has an organized and fully supported defense system. Notice he sets guards on the walls. He's now divided his workforce up into two groups, the ones that are working and the ones that are holding weapons and watching. One of the most important things he did is he put a guard up, somebody to be watchful, somebody to see the attackers if they come. See, in order for us to neutralize distractions, we must be watchful. We must set a guard over our homes. And part of that is creating a filter for our homes. Many of you have your computers, and hopefully you have some sort of filter on them to block out the stuff that you nor your family needs to see. Because there's plenty of content out there that we don't need in our home, and that's just one way we need to filter what enters our homes. We need to filter our televisions. There's a lot of garbage coming in, a lot of entertainment coming in that we don't need. We need to filter our social media. We need to filter what our children have access to. I think Eric did a lesson earlier this week on social media and stuff like that. But we have to start crafting a way to prevent our families from being exposed to sources that come into our home that don't belong. We need to filter the people we allow in our homes. We need to filter the clothes we allow in our homes. We need to filter any form of entertainment that comes into our homes, because we need to have control over what our children are exposed to, what our families are exposed to, what we ourselves as men are exposed to. It's Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23, where we're told to, above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Still remember an illustration that Rick Whittle gave at a summer series at our church years ago about Fort Knox. You ever looked at what we do know about the protective barriers at Fort Knox? It's ridiculous. It's important. Supposedly there's a bunch of gold there that, you know, we haven't seen since the 70s, but it's supposedly there. But they've set up so many different systems and barriers to prevent someone from trying to access it that shouldn't. Guard your heart, because it's the wellspring of life. As leaders of our homes, it's not just our hearts that we have to guard, that we have to play a part in protecting. So we've got to put together a defense system for our homes and for our families. Because I want you to think about Lot for just a second. What's interesting to me is that Lot was a good guy. Lot was deemed righteous. He was allowed to leave Sodom. But how did he get there in the first place? He's been hanging out with Abraham for years. A man of faith. The father of righteousness and whatnot. God's friend. How did that not rub off on Lot? Well, it did to some degree. Lot was deemed righteous enough to leave Sodom. But you recall that day when Abraham and Lot realize they can't stay together anymore. And it's Lot's eyes that mess him up. He looks over there and sees really good land. And now he's attracted to that land. And he moves in the direction of that land. When he moves away from Abraham, he doesn't move directly into Sodom. He doesn't go and buy residence there. No, it's Genesis chapter 13, verse 12, that we're told that Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Notice he's not even in Sodom yet. He's just going in the direction of Sodom. The next time we read about Lot is Genesis chapter 14, where he's living inside the city limits of Sodom, but we find out that he's dwelling in Sodom, but we find out that he's captured now. A group of kings decide they don't like Sodom where it's at anymore, and they go capture the residents. Abraham has to go save him. Now here's the thing. If anybody ever invaded Pensacola and took all of us captive and somebody came and rescued us, I'm not moving back to Pensacola. I'm finding a much safer place to live. I'm moving to Fort Knox or something. I don't know. I'm moving somewhere that's safer. But Lot moves right back into the same city he was captured from. And years later, a couple of angels show up and say, it's time to get out. And when they say it's time to get out, he was sitting at the gate. He was there. Maybe he's revered in the community and that's why he's at the gate. Or maybe he's at the gate because he's watching for potential visitors that he doesn't want to have what is attempted upon the lives on these two messengers when they arrive. But when they tell him it's time to go, did he leave immediately? Did he pack up and get out as fast as possible? Because I mean, they told him God was going to destroy it. No, the text says he hesitated. He had become so accustomed to the community, so desensitized to his society, that it was hard for him to leave. So hard, in fact, that his wife, as the text says, looked back, as Jesus alluded to in one of his statements in Luke, she actually probably started heading back because they were just so desensitized. They never protected. They never had a defense system. They allowed themselves to be weakened over time. And guess what? The worst part of the story hadn't even happened yet. The worst part of the story was what his daughters did to him. And where do you think they learned such sexually immoral behavior? My guess is in the city. My guess is in the city that was so willing to rape if given the opportunity. And because Lot didn't protect his family, because Lot didn't have a defense system, he exposed them to influences they didn't need. And one final thought. If you look at Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 19 and 20, you see that Nehemiah is worried about how spread out the people are in the community. And so he tells the nobles and the officials and all the people, the work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. In other words, what Nehemiah realized is that their defense system necessitated that they assemble. You know Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. The context of that passage in Hebrews indicates that this is an instruction. It's the third let us instruction of that passage. And the author of Hebrews identifies the purpose of meeting together as a means of stimulating spiritual life. And he presents this as an expectation that the assembling of the church and the encouragement it provides will increase rather than decrease over time. Here's the thing. Probably the greatest hindrance to our families, and granted, I know we're Church of Christ, but I'm speaking to the choir right now. Forgive me for using that example in the Churches of Christ. But I'm talking to the individuals that this probably isn't the biggest problem with. Because we've got a lot of preachers here. We're paid to be there on Sunday. I mean, that's our only day of work during the week, so we might as well be there. The greatest problem for our members today is that they don't realize how important it is to assemble. That is where we are empowered. That is where we are stimulated. That is where we're built up and encouraged to put up with this world we're stuck in for now. We all know the issues we have with, say, Sunday night. Everybody's Sunday night hurts. But it's part of our society teaching us that assembling just doesn't matter anymore. And what fascinates me is when I look at the first century church, the earliest Christians, they met daily. They didn't just meet on Sundays and Wednesdays. They met daily in the temple's courts, in each other's homes. And I think they needed to be in the presence of one another on a daily basis because they were enduring some tremendous opposition in the first century. And so, as Hebrews 3:13 states, they were encouraging one another daily so that they wouldn't be hardened by the sin's deceitfulness. And such frequent encouragement required frequent interaction. And I think that's where we in the 21st century mess up. We don't create enough opportunities for daily assembly. Because you notice the author of Hebrews didn't specify how frequently you assemble. Just said, when you do, be there. I think the other thing we need to realize if we want to neutralize distractions is as the church, we need to create more opportunities for Christians to be with Christians. For us to be together because it's collectively that we're stronger. Let me close out with one little illustration because Ray stole mine that I was going to start off with about Yogi Berra and Hank Aaron. That's all right. I didn't have enough time to use it anyway. Back years ago in the 1800s, there were a couple of paddle boats that left Memphis at about the same time, traveling down the Mississippi River. They were headed down to New Orleans. And as they were traveling side by side, some sailors from one of the paddle boats started, making a few more remarks about the slow pace of the other one. And so words were exchanged, challenges were made, and a race began. Now, the paddle boats were carrying cargo. It wasn't for pedestrians. It was carrying shipments down to New Orleans. And after a while, one paddle boat got ahead of the other. And it's because the slower paddle boat was running out of fuel. They had enough fuel on board, enough coal on board to make it to New Orleans, but not to compete in a race. But one of the enterprising young sailors on board that paddle boat decided to throw some cargo in. And so they started burning cargo and realized it burned well enough to pick up their speed. And so for the rest of the trip, they just threw their cargo into the fire to keep the steam going. They ended up winning the race, but in the process, they burned everything they were supposed to deliver. We've got some precious cargo. Cargo entrusted to us by God. It's our children. It's our spouses. And our job is to do our part in seeing that the cargo reaches its destination. The problem is that too many of us get distracted by other objectives. We get caught up in finishing the race first. We get caught up in looking at the scenery along the way. We get caught up in how fast we're traveling. And we have to remember that the cargo we carry is more precious than silver, as Peter said. So therefore, we need this mindset. We need the mindset of Nehemiah in Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3, where a distraction came, and this was his response. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? We need the mindset of Nehemiah to neutralize our distraction. And Lord willing, we won't make the mistakes of those paddleboat racers and burn up the cargo for a fleeting reward.